What can we expect from Hamas now that there is a new political leader?
That the path for Hamas runs through Gaza. And fundamentally, Hamas is willing to fight until the very bitter end, not only for its own survival as an organization, but from its point of view, for the future of the Palestinian people.
Plus, a look at the foreign policy of vice presidential candidate Tim Walz.
You know, one thing I would point out when it comes to China and trade more generally is that he may actually be a little bit more of a trade-oriented Democrat.
And later, riots continue in Britain, hunger in Nigeria, and a Taylor Swift concert was targeted by terrorists. Today is Thursday, August 8th, and this is VOA's Flashpoint. Good evening, I'm Steve Karish in Washington. Yahya Sinwar is believed to be the architect of the October 7th terror attacks on Israel. And as we've reported here previously, he's now the Palestinian militant group's new political chief, as well as its military leader based in Gaza. Analysts say Sinwar is unlikely to conclude a ceasefire deal with Israel to end fighting in Gaza and return hostages, even though a Hamas spokesperson says Sinwar will continue negotiations. Dale Gavlak reports from Amman.
Nicholas Harris of Washington's New Lines Institute tells VOA Yahya Sinwar's unanimous appointment as Hamas's new political chief shows that Gaza is now center stage and not Qatar, where the political leadership has been based.
Now, Hamas is making a very clear statement to the world, not just to Israel, the United States, Qatar, or Egypt, that the path for Hamas runs through Gaza. And fundamentally, Hamas is willing to fight until the very bitter end, not only for its own survival as an organization, but from its point of view, for the future of the Palestinian people. Hamas is signaling to the Israelis and whomever works with them that there is no way to separate Gaza and the future of Gaza from Hamas.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says it's now up to Yahya Sinwar to clinch a ceasefire deal in the 10-month Gaza conflict because he has been and remains the primary decider. This indicates that was the case even when top Hamas negotiator Ismail Haniyeh, considered relatively more moderate, was still alive. Khaled Haroub, a Hamas specialist at Northwestern University in Qatar, told France's Le Monde newspaper that if Israel, the United States, and their allies in the region and beyond were hoping to subdue Hamas by force, the response will be a more radical Hamas. He said he does not see a softening of the group's position as Washington and Qatar try to reach a deal in hopes of reducing the current escalation between Israel and Iran. Cynthia Bianco, a Gulf specialist at the European Council on Foreign Relations, tells VOA that Qatar has tried for 8 months to see a deal happen. But Hamas really takes its cues from Iran.
They only respond to Iran and perhaps to other external backers, to some extent, Russia and China as well. The political cause and the military cause are one and the same. That means that Qatar's leverage is also less.
Israeli and U.S. intelligence officers told the New York Times that Sinwar's strategy is to keep the war in Gaza going for as long as it takes to shred Israel's international reputation and to damage its relationship with its primary ally, the United States. Nicholas Harris says he sees Sinwar both influenced by slain Iranian Republican Guard Corps General Qasem Soleimani and using his Israel playbook. Harris said Soleimani developed an entire strategy to create a network of proxies and partners that surround Israel, including Hamas, to seek its destruction.
Over time, a series of attritional conflicts with Israel will undermine the foundation of Israel economically, socially, politically, and then geopolitically. All those elements have been present in this current conflict that Hamas initiated on October 7, 2023. And we're seeing this Soleimani playbook continue to be enacted.
Observers say they see both Sinwar and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as unwilling to reach a ceasefire agreement for their own political reasons. Dale Gavlak, VOA News, Amman.
Following the death of Ismail Haniyeh in Tehran last week, both Iran and Hamas have blamed Israel and promised revenge. Now, as Israelis wait, Israel's ambulance service has stocked blood supplies in a fortified underground center, factories have moved out hazardous materials, and municipal authorities are checking bomb shelters and water supplies. The urgency has risen sharply over the past 2 weeks. Along with Haniyeh's death, a relatively contained conflict with the Iran-backed Hezbollah movement in Lebanon has also threatened to spiral into an all-out war. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu urges calm. Behind the threats, though, is something deeper. What is it about Israel that offends Iranian leadership so much that they're funding armies in other countries? Iran is 1,500 kilometers from Israel. The two countries aren't involved in a territorial dispute. Iranians are Persians, and Palestinians are Arabs. They don't speak the same language. Other Muslim theocracies and Muslim-majority countries support the Palestinians politically in the UN and with humanitarian aid, and while they might not like what Israel is doing, they're not taking their opposition to the same violent level that Iran is. For a look at why, I spoke with Eli Kohanim. She's a senior fellow at the Independent Women's Forum, and she was the State Department's first Iranian-born envoy.
Steve, it's an excellent question, and in answering it, I want to immediately distinguish between the Islamic Republic regime, which is, I would argue, currently occupying Iran, and the Iranian people. And the Iranian people have no ill will towards Israel. In fact, before the Islamic Revolution in 1979, we know that the Shah of Iran had very close ties with Israel. So the Iranian people have a history of working closely with Israelis, whether it was diplomatic ties. There was a lot of economic activity between the two countries, and as well as government ties. In 1979, when the Ayatollah Khomeini came to Iran and grabbed power after the revolution, he immediately set about a radical Islamist theology which rejects the very notion of Jewish sovereignty in the Middle East. And I would argue that that is the root of the hatred that we're seeing the regime display on a daily basis in Iran, what I have termed an obsessive anti-Semitism, in the sense that the regime's almost full activity is dedicated to what they tell us they want to do, which is to eradicate Israel.
Iran doesn't seem to have a problem with other countries that are so closely identified with a specific religion. Hindus in India, for example, there's a lot of Hindu nationalism going on that, while Iran might not like, they're not taking the same offensive steps towards. The Vatican, Catholics in Rome. Iran doesn't have the opposition to those countries and those groups. What is it specifically about Jews in Israel that has the Iranians so offended?
Steve, it's an interpretation of Islam that the Islamic regime in Iran has taken and championed. It's an interpretation of Islam which views Islam as the final religion and Muhammad as the final prophet. And so if that is your understanding of Islam, I think it becomes threatening to the very understanding of your religion to countenance that the Jewish people still exist, so the Jewish religion still exists, and it is so successful, in fact, that the Jewish people have their own sovereign state in the Middle East. And so to your first question as to why the Islamic Republic regime has become so obsessively anti-Semitic and anti-Israel at a time when we're seeing the moderate Gulf Arab states, as an example, the United Arab Emirates, Bahrain, and even Saudi Arabia, Egypt, Jordan, right? All these countries are able to make peace with Israel, live neighborly with Israel, even have diplomatic relations. Why is it that the Islamic Republic can't do that. And it's because the Islamic Republic regime is so fanatical in their interpretation of Islam that it has become a thorn on their side.
You started off our conversation by separating the regime from the people. And if, by and large, the people of Iran do not have this fanatical hatred of Israel, clearly there must be some disagreement, some argument with the regime that some of these resources they're giving to groups like Hezbollah and Hamas could be better used at home. Are there divisions on those political lines back inside Iran?
Well, absolutely. And we've seen this, on social media. We've seen videos coming out of Iran where people are chanting in Farsi, not for Lebanon, not for Gaza, but for Iran. And it's exactly referring to what you mentioned, Steve, which is that the Iranian people are incredibly frustrated to see a wealthy country with so much natural resource. We're talking about oil and natural gas and other resources being squandered by the regime on their terror proxies in Lebanon and Gaza and elsewhere. And so, yes, we've seen the Iranian people take to the streets and chant that they don't want this. They're not interested in the regime's destabilizing activity across the region. They're not interested in the regime using the country's resources to spend on terror proxies, to spend on the nuclear program, and, of course, to line their own pockets.
L.A. Kohanim is a senior fellow at the Independent Women's Forum. Ms. Kohanim, thanks very much for your analysis today. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Changing gears now, we go to England. Thousands of police and anti-racism protesters gathered on streets across Britain on Wednesday to challenge the far-right groups following more than a week of violent racist attacks targeting Muslims and migrants. Reuters' Ryan Chang has more.
Large crowds turned out in anti-racism protests across Britain on Wednesday, a challenge to planned far-right demonstrations after more than a week of violent riots and attacks across the country targeting Muslims and migrants. Hundreds denounced racism at a gathering in Liverpool, chanting slogans and waving banners. And in London, aerial footage showed Walthamstow and the city's northeast flooded with anti-racism protesters, a mix of Muslims, anti-racist and anti-fascist groups, left-wing organizations, and locals. Britain has been roiled in violent clashes last week after three young girls were killed in a stabbing in the northwest city of Southport. A wave of false messaging online wrongly identified the suspected killer as an Islamist migrant. Ahead of Wednesday, there were reports anti-Muslim protesters would attack a list of immigration centers, migrant support centers, and specialist law firms. Many shops closed early and some boarded up windows. By nightfall on Wednesday, there were no signs that large far-right groups had gathered, except for disturbances in some communities. Authorities say a standing army of around 6,000 police officers were ready to respond to any violence. There's also increased security at mosques across the country. These places of prayer have been pelted with rocks. At least two mosques in the north of England were targeted by violent mobs. At Liverpool's Al Rahma Mosque, the largest in the city, a handful of worshippers have been sleeping inside at night, and most entrances have been blocked. Abdul Wasif Sufian, a 20-year-old student who helps at the Al Rahma, says he hasn't stepped outside his immediate neighborhood out of fears for his safety.
Seeing the events that have just taken place in the city of Liverpool, and not just the city of Liverpool, but in the UK as a whole, it's really scary seeing the people rioting, looting the shops.
Another local, Santosh Thomas, says it's not just Muslims who are afraid.
I'm from India. To be honest, I can't come out and tell to the protesters or the people who are running towards me, hundreds of crowds, that, oh no, I'm not a Muslim, I'm from India, please don't spare me. That's not possible. So everyone is scared.
Migration to Britain was a major factor in the 2016 vote for the UK to leave the European Union, and was also a key battleground in last month's election. The country's far-right Reform Party won around 4 million votes on calls for tighter border controls. UK Prime Minister Keir Starmer has labelled the recent unrest far-right thuggery and has warned rioters they would face lengthy jail terms.
That's Ryan Chang of Reuters reporting for us. You're listening to Flashpoint from the Voice of America. I'm Steve Karish in Washington. A terror attack was thwarted ahead of a Taylor Swift concert in Vienna. More on that later. Up first, though, a look at foreign policy. When J.D. Vance was named as Donald Trump's running mate, he was a senator. He was an outspoken critic of American aid to Ukraine. He told a group of European allies that Europe should spend more on its own defense and not rely on the U.S. He believes in focusing America's military against what he sees as a threat coming from China. But what of Tim Walz's foreign policy ideas? As a governor rather than a senator, his foreign policy positions are less understood. Helping me get to the bottom of it is Chris Tuttle, a senior fellow and managing director of the Council on Foreign Relations.
Well, you know, you can take a look back at his history in the House of Representatives. All folks in Congress have to vote on foreign policy issues regularly. So there is a record there. You know, when it comes to the issues that, you know, we see out there, he's pretty much within the sort of the mainstream of the Democratic Party on most issues. You know, when it comes to Russia, Ukraine, he's certainly supportive of continuing assistance to Ukraine and doing everything that we can to push back against the Russians. When it comes to, you know, China, he, you know, certainly is somebody who has been concerned about China human rights when he was in the House. You know, one thing I would point out when it comes to China and trade more generally is that he may actually be a little bit more of a trade-oriented Democrat within the current context of the Democratic Party because of his time as a governor, his time, you know, coming from an agricultural state.
Well, what does that mean to be trade oriented?
So more pro-trade and more more likely to support sort of a more liberal trading regime, less concentration on tariffs, those kinds of things to encourage freer trade between countries so that we can sell our goods abroad.
Now, Walz has famously spent a lot of time in China. How does that inform his opinions with security in the region, in the South China Sea, Straits of Taiwan, but also trading with China?
Yeah, I think that remains to be seen. You know, I think my guess is he's going to be very much sort of a security oriented Democrat when it comes to China in sort of the same mold as Joe Biden and now, you know, Kamala Harris. Again, I would just say that I think on the trade question, he may be more willing to look at trade and say we need to have these trading relationships. Additional tariffs on China are not a great idea. He criticized Trump's trade policy toward China, so that might be one area where he is he steps a little bit out of the sort of Democratic mainstream.
Have we seen anything from Tim Walz as a governor that should concern international partners or allies?
Not that I have seen. I have not seen things that he's done as a governor that would be concerning to international allies, with the possible exception of the Israelis and how, you know, where he's going to come down. What his statements have said have been very much in the mainstream of sort of standard congressional Democrats or even the administration. Whether or not he, you know, would push the administration to move further toward, you know, not being supportive of Israel is an open question.
That's Chris Tuttle with the Council on Foreign Relations. We've been reporting on the famine conditions in Sudan recently. Sadly, it's not the only area of concern in Africa. On the other side of the continent, an unprecedented surge in malnutrition in Nigeria has aid group Doctors Without Borders concerned. The organization says it's scaling up inpatient care and working with the local community to treat cases of malnutrition earlier to prevent more severe cases and deaths. Timothy Obiezu reports from Abuja.
Doctors Without Borders, also known by its French acronym MSF, says it recorded an alarming 23,000 cases of severe malnutrition in Nigeria's Bauchi state between January and June this year, a 120% increase over the same period a year before. The group on Tuesday also said overall malnutrition in the West African nation increased by 40% nationwide and warned that without immediate intervention, the situation could become catastrophic. MSF has been responding to malnutrition crisis in Bauchi since 2022. The group said its treatment centers and personnel are overstretched and that they're trying to make room for more sick children. Nigeria has the second highest burden of growth-stunted children in the world, according to UNICEF, the United Nations Children's Fund. UNICEF says malnutrition is the direct or underlying cause of 45% of all deaths in the country under the age of five. For years, Nigeria has been embroiled in a protracted war with armed gangs who often kidnap farmers and hold them for ransom. The resulting loss of food production, along with general insecurity and rising food prices, have hampered the ability of vulnerable people to buy food. The situation is especially bad around July and August each year, the so-called peak of the lean season, when food from previous harvests normally runs out. Last month, MSF launched a community-based intervention known as Integrated Community Case Management in 8 villages and equipped local women with early testing tools to help them detect malnutrition faster. Boyom says it is bridging the gap.
They were trained to be able to identify malnutrition, sign of severity or medical complication. But also they were trained to manage on the spot the cases of simple malnutrition. On top of that, they are also trained to manage malaria.
But until insecurity is addressed and there's more funding to help the vulnerable, many more children will be struggling to survive. Timothy Obiezu, VOA News, Abuja, Nigeria.
And finally today, though a potential disaster has been averted, it's still a sad day for many, many people. Taylor Swift's 3 concerts in Vienna were canceled after government confirmation of a planned terror attack at the stadium, the organizers said late Wednesday. Freddie Joyner of Reuters has more.
Pop megastar Taylor Swift's 3 concerts in Vienna were abruptly canceled after Austrian police arrested 2 people suspected of plotting an attack. The Austrian government confirmed a planned attack at Ernst Happel Stadium. That's according to concert organizer Barracuda.music, saying in a Facebook post on Wednesday, quote, "With confirmation from government officials of a planned terrorist attack, we have no choice but to cancel the 3 scheduled shows for everyone's safety." The organizer added that all tickets for the shows would be automatically refunded. Austria's Chancellor Karl Niehammer said in a post on social media platform X that a tragedy was prevented. Austrian police on Wednesday detained 2 people suspected of plotting attacks on concerts, according to the Director General for Public Security. The 3 Swift concerts were scheduled to take place from Thursday to Saturday, with police expecting around 65,000 attendees each day. They are part of the record-breaking Eras tour by the American singer-songwriter set to conclude on December 8th.
That's Reuters' Freddie Joyner reporting for us today. And that's going to wrap up today's show. There's more VOA coverage 24 hours a day on our website, voanews.com, and across our social media platforms. On behalf of everyone here at VOA, thanks for listening. Until tomorrow, I'm Steve Karish. Look what you made me do. Look what you made me do. Look what you just made me do. Look what you just made me do. Look what you made me do. Look what you made me do. Look what you just made me do. Look what you just made me do. Look what you made me do.
For deeper dives and expert analysis, listen to VOA Podcasts. Issues in the News explores the biggest stories every weekend, while International Edition keeps you informed every weekday. Plus, with the 5-minute newscast at the top of every hour, you're always up to date.